to the Golf in Mind. Historically, the podcast, we talk about golf in general and the mental game of golf in particular. But last week, I shared a story about a golf experience of mine called the Awesome Eight, where a friend and I set out to play the eight most extreme golf courses in the world. So rather than talk about the mental game of golf today, I wanted to talk about this golf adventure and look at some aspects of mental resilience and toughing it out in some very difficult conditions during our challenge. As I say, last week it was the 1 year anniversary of the podcast, so I wanted to do something a little different, just to share some thoughts and reflections on an adventure of mine on the golf course that didn't involve me hitting a shot that you really wouldn't be interested in hearing about, because I'd either lie about it or exaggerate. No, I'm joking. I wouldn't do either of the things. I wouldn't discuss my golf in great detail, because I think other people's golf is as uninteresting to them. I have a friend, if you ever say to him, how'd you play? He will take you through 18 holes of golf and describe every shot in detail, including the practice swing. And I'm not joking. So I never say, how did you play? I say, did you have a good game? And he goes, yes. And I stop him at that point and say, oh, and change the subject. But last week I talked about the first part of the Awesome Eight, where we went to North America to play the coldest course in Fairbanks, Alaska, the lowest course in the world in Furnace Creek, and which is in the Mojave Desert, and to play the most difficult, toughest course in the world, which was a place called Kualua in Hawaii. But we had five more courses to play. We had to play the greatest, we had to play the most northern, the most southern, the highest and the hottest. So we broke it into three trips. One trip would be to South America and Australia. That would enable us to play the highest, the most southern and the hottest. And then a trip to Scandinavia to play the most northern. And finally a trip to the greatest course of the world. And I'll save that for the very end. Research indicated that the most northern golf course in the world wasn't Fairbanks, Alaska, which I had thought. It was, in fact, a golf course called, and I think it's called Laxlev, and it's inside the Arctic Circle, very close to the border of Finland, and that becomes relevant. It's a six-hole course with three tee boxes, so they can play 18. The course was designed by, I often joke, a mechanical digger, because the bunkers were literally gouged with a machine, and they've kind of banked them up. But you have the midnight sun, so we played at midnight, and the only thing that was very challenging was the industrial sized mosquitoes, which came in like Chinook helicopters. You could hear them 30 seconds before they landed. This is a sort of remote part of the world. It's in the far north, and like Fairbanks, the people are very welcoming of those who come to visit them. We rented a little lodge. We had to hire a car. We drove. And I remember there wasn't a lot there, but we went to the golf club, and there was no clubhouse. There's just a container. I think it was an industrial container, which they used as a sort of starter hut, a little changing area. And the club champion arranged to play with us. So we're very flattered by this. And when he turned up dressed with the most amazing plaid pants I'd seen, and he looked like they'd only had golf magazines dating to 1966, because it really was wide lapels and fantastic. I mean, they just so love their golf up there. And so this club champion I was very impressed with, and he told me his handicap was 18. So I asked him, do they have a pro? They said, no, for a few days every year, I think it was the Norwegian Golf Federation sent a professional up to give classes or something. Anyway, we teed off and we played the six holes three times in three different tee boxes. It was one of those lovely courses like Fairbanks, Alaska, where the members take incredible pride in what they have. They're open and welcoming. The course isn't in any way challenging. There's no water. The bunkers are just gouged out the ground. The greens don't get rolled, they cut them. There's one double green, so you have five greens to give you 18 holes, so go figure. But it was great. I mean, I loved it. Absolutely great. So that's the most northern course. We then planned a trip to South America, where we wanted to play the highest course in the world, and that was in La Paz. Now, I'd never been at that kind of altitude of 8, 9, 10,000 feet. So when the plane lands, and it lands at a feral lick because of the lack of air density, you get off the plane and you take a few steps and you suddenly go, oh, I'm a bit short of breath, because you suddenly realize the air is significantly thinner. So we knew we had to spend 4 or 5 days to acclimatize. And we booked into this hotel, we'd booked online, and went for a wander around the town. But I get tired walking up the hills. You're going, poor, this is hard work. And one night, I organized dinner in a nicer restaurant with a great steak. And the next day, my friend said, well, let's go to the street market near the bus station, where we had meat on a stick. And that's all I can tell you. It was meat on a stick. I have no idea the origin of this meat. And it wasn't incredibly tasty. It was slightly chewy. So I'm reserving judgment on what I ate, but I can only say I saw very, very few wild dogs in that part of the world. So draw your own conclusions. But we turn up at the Club La Paz, and as was the case with some places, we had to tee it up. We had to pay a green fee, which, you know, is fair enough. Even though we were doing this for charity, doesn't mean that the clubs we play need to give it to us for free. Those that did, it was greatly appreciated. But they insisted we have a caddy. I don't know why, but we didn't want a caddy because we carried our own bags. Now, the caddy just came for the walk. And you're playing it just under 11,000 feet up above sea level. I mean, really high. That's the level some commuter planes fly at. And I remember the landscape was sensational. I mean, it's just like the moon. And it was explained to me that I think George Lucas filmed part of Star Wars there because it was just so otherworldly. So we tee off, and I remember coming to this 580-yard par 5. But the hole before was about 240-yard par 3. It was very long. And the caddy looked at me and goes, Cinco, which I know means 5. So I thought, really? Because I was looking at my 3-wood, and I put my hand in my 5-wood. He goes, no, senor, cinco. And he meant 5-iron. I'm thinking, I can't hit a 5-iron 240 yards. But I did that day because it's so rarefied. You hit it miles. The next hole, 580 yards of drive and a 4-iron. Woo! Great stuff. And we played that, and we take that box off. And then we went down to the most southern course in the world, Tierra del Fuego. And I love that place. This is another course run by the members. The person who took our green fee also served us our drinks. Turned out he was also the greenkeeper. We later discovered when we got to the 10th tee, he was waiting for us with a set of golf clubs. He was also the club professional. He played level par for the back nine. He played in jeans. And I looked at his golf clubs, and there were no two clubs that matched. He didn't have a match set. He had a set of irons that he'd cobbled together from clubs he'd got his hands on. Isn't that golf in its purest form? There's one person who's a club pro, the barman, chief cook, bottle washer, greenkeeper, the meter, the greeter, and the ambassador for the club. Just absolute. Now, the thing about this most selling course in the world is Tierra del Fuego is windy, windy, windy. I mean, the flags roll just like anger. The noise you hear at over most shots is your trousers flapping. So I suggest if you play it, plain skinny jeans. And being a Scotsman, people always assume I can play in the wind. I never disavow them of that belief, especially in America. When I go somewhere it's windy, and they go, hey, Robin, you Scottish guys, you know how to play the wind. And I go, aye, aye, that's great. We know how to play the wind. I'll just give you a master class myself. And I haven't a clue how to play the wind. I mean, play it back in your stands, hit down, deal off the club. Good in theory, not all sorts of good in practice. We then went down to Chile, Santiago, where we got a flight to Australia. Now, we landed in Australia, and my friend who was organising this part of the trip didn't get visas for us. So we landed in Australia without a visa. And they don't let you into Australia without a visa. But that day they did, because I'd had a previous visa, they could see I'd been there before. and we were allowed to enter the country. And the I never forget this. The woman at immigration said, "There's only one person in the world who can come to this country without a visa. That's Her Majesty the Queen." So I was very flattered to be in the same category of elitism as Her Majesty the Queen, that I get into Australia. And we headed off to play the hottest course in the world, which we calculated on Midsummer's Day, the 22nd of December, would be Alice Springs. In fact, this was the last of the eight. I'll come back to the greatest shortly. Dramatic tension, isn't it great when you build it up? And we go to Alice Springs and we pitch up at the club the night before to say who we are and what we're going to do. They couldn't have been more hospitable. They were delighted to have us. The captain had come out to see us, the chairman, the pro. They were all just saying so pleased we'd come, so delighted we were going to play golf. They had us a tea time at 9:15. I think they'd got us trolleys that we could so we could pool. There was someone going to film us in a cart, and we had to create our clothing so we were going to cope with the heat. Now we imagined, as in Fairbanks, Alaska, when you play the coldest course on the coldest day, it's going to be empty. That morning we woke up and the temperature was forecast for 44, and the course was rammed. I mean, packed, every tee time taken up because there was a competition. I have a photograph of my watch showing a surface temperature of 52 degrees centigrade. It was scorcho. There was water containers every three holes, and you would just take two cups and pour it over your head. The locals seemed to cope with this much better than I, so my level of endurance, which I thought was going to be tested to the max, was rather sidelined by the stunning performance of this course. It was just a cracking course. I mean, it's a course where people love golf. It's flat. I can't remember many features about it, but what I do remember is this: is when we finished the course, came off the course, and we shook hands with each other and went into the clubhouse. The captain came up and said, "Congratulations, we're really pleased for you. Here's a donation," which was unheard of. "By the way, we're throwing a barbecue in your honor this evening." And how about that? We'd gone around the world playing these courses, and the members at Alice Springs Golf Course, to which I give a big shout out, and this is 2002, threw barbecue for us, and we had barbecued, drank beers, photos were taken. I think a few speeches were made, very short speeches because it got in the way of drinking. And nobody made me drink a Bundaberg and rum, which I'm eternally grateful for. So that was it. We did the Awesome Eight. So what about the greatest course? Well, in the first part of this podcast last week, I talked about how do you just, what is greatness? Is it status, prestige? Is it a ranking? Is it historical? Is it personal? Is it emotional? I don't know. I now would qualify what I think. So I thought the greatest course should be one that is universally accepted to be the greatest, and you would have the least trouble persuading others that that was the case. So, being a Scotsman, it will come as no real surprise it was the old course, St Andrews. And why do I regret that decision? Well, for kind of two reasons. We wrote to the old course and the Links Trust to say that we were going around the world to play these eight courses. St Andrews had been selected. And we wanted to be able to guarantee a tee time because we're not members, obviously. And there was a ballot system. So you put your name into the ballot the day before and you either get a tee time or you don't. But due to our scheduling, we couldn't afford to do that. So what we had to do was to ask very respectfully if we could get it. And I explained it was for our charity. This is how much money we were hoping to raise. And I got a rather snooty, sniffy, short, taciturn reply to the effect of, "You have to enter the ballot. If it was a Scottish charity, we may look upon this more favourably, but in the circumstances, we cannot." And I was just incredibly disappointed. You know, here it is, the home of golf, the greatest course. People trying to do something quite good for an orphanage in Thailand. And all they have to do is to give you a tee time out of the ballot. And I know there's protocols, and I know there's no favoritism should be shown, but trust me, As the old joke goes, if a man, there's an old joke that a man turns up at the old course and says, "I'd like a tea time tomorrow." They said, "There's no vacancies." And the fellow says, "If Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, and Tom Watson turned up tomorrow, would they get a tea time?" And the starter said, "Well, yes, of course they would." He goes, "Well, good. They're not coming, so I'll take theirs." And I was just disappointed. So what I did was I did something I didn't particularly want to do. I contacted a very good friend who was a member of the RNA. And I said, "Could you book a tea time for us to play with you?" So he did. And he could only get a late tea time. And this was October time. So we flew up and we turned up at St. Andrews at 4 o'clock. It was going to be dark at 7. We knew that. And there's a guy standing by himself, a single. And we asked him, was he looking to play? He said he'd like to play. He was a German surgeon. So we said, "Well, why don't you come and play with us?" So we had a game together. We get to the 15th, it's getting dark. 16th, we play in the dark. The 17th, we play in the dark. But there's a beautiful picture taken on the 18th of somebody driving with the town lit up behind us. And as we get to the 18th tee, the member turns around and he says to the German, "Would you like to have a drink with us later?" And the German guy goes, "Oh, that'd be fantastic." He goes, "No, in the clubhouse." He said, "I'm a member of the RNA." But he said, "You need a jacket and tie." And this German guy was so thrilled. He said, "Okay, I go." And he ran to the hotel. I think he was staying in the Russex Hotel with his wife. I hope he wasn't on his honeymoon. We finished the golf. He appeared at the door. We sat and had a beer. And that was it. The awesome eight. If you look it up online, you can find information. The photograph in today's podcast is a picture of me having played 18 holes at minus 26. A bit frosty. Anyway, this is us celebrating our 1 year anniversary, the second part of it. Going forward, I'd like to just talk about golf in more general terms, as well as the mental game. But everything I really want to say about the mental game has been said in the previous podcast. Of course, I'll do more and repeat different areas. I'm working on a brand new book at the moment called The Modern Fundamentals of the Mental Game of Golf. And that's going to be coming out in October next year. And that's it, really. As always, please, if you'd like to learn to play or develop your mental game, go to my online training program, seeyourgolf.com. And until we meet again, please play your golf, have a great time, and be kind to yourself, as I recommend to all my golfers and all my friends, because that's where it all starts.